Welcome to Crash Concepts, where the economy, energy, and the environment are explored. Up next, fresh ideas and insights into the factors that are driving the world and shaping your future. Presenting information you can't afford to live without, here's Chris Martinson.
Welcome to this Peak Prosperity podcast. I am your host, Chris Martinson, and today we have the pleasure of speaking once again with Joel Salatin, one of the most visible and influential leaders in the organic food and sustainable farming movements. His family owns and manages Polyface Farms, which is featured prominently in such modern food movement masterworks as Omnivore's Dilemma by Mukku Pallan, the book, and in the documentaries Fresh, Food Inc., American Meat, and most recently, Polyfaces. And of course, he has the blurb on the back of our latest book, Prosper. We last spoke to Joel in 2015, and that podcast was very well received, widely listened to, sparked numerous conversations. Hey, look, I can't wait to get started, as the conversation's always lively, informative, and sure to arouse both curiosity and maybe a slight whiff of alarm. No, not really. Joel, welcome back.
Thank you, Chris. It's wonderful to be with you.
Hey, let's start with the new documentary, Polyfaces. Tell us about that.
Well, it's a documentary put out by the Regrarians from Australia. This is a family that is that has traveled the world for about 20 years setting up dynamic farm design programs. Kind of started out from a permaculture perspective, but they've kind of developed their own permutation of that. And they just wanted to showcase what we were doing here and decided it was a story worth telling. We had not had a documentary done on us just featuring the farm, you know, and so that's what they did, and it's out there, and we'll see. I mean, we don't own it; they own it. They're distributing it. They're in charge. But we've certainly appreciated, you know, having the story out there in a wider audience.
Well, great. How'd they do?
I'm sorry.
How did they do? How'd the film come out?
Oh, well, pretty well. You know, everybody, films are a little bit artistic, you know, and there's certainly some subjectivity to it. I'll tell you what, they put in their time. There's some beautiful, probably some of the best videography done for on the farm that's ever been done. But, you know, they were here for like, you know, 30 days over the course of 4 years. And so, you know, the neat things about the documentary are that it does go over such a long time that you actually see their children grow up. You see our grandchildren, you know, go yeah. 4 years older.
Uh-huh.
You see, you know, me lose some more hair and that sort of thing. You know, the time element, you really get a sense watching it that there is a time element. That's kind of neat. And so they were here for all different seasons, captured a lot of different things that other things that we've been in have not captured because they haven't, you know, gone through all the different seasons. I think that if there's a negative to it, from my perspective, it's a little choppy. It doesn't flow as nicely as I'd like, but see, I'm a storyteller. I like the continuity of a story and to take a theme through, and I feel like there's a bit of a choppiness to it, you know, where they don't actually finish one story, they start another one, then they come back to the previous one, and it's a little bit of a choppiness to it, but the themes that run throughout and the videography, the cinematography is outstanding. They capture a chicken, you know, actually picking a maggot out of a cow pie, you know, in slow-mo, close-up. It's amazing. Picking a chicken, picking a grasshopper off of a grass plant, you know, and just that violence of nature. It's quite amazing.
Oh, that must be nice to have that captured in that loving detail like that. So to have that as part of your record there is certainly wonderful. I guess, you know, people come over, they have a choice now, right? They can either go through your wedding album with you or watch the movie, right? So,
And personally, for me, it was especially neat to capture, the ladies in the group, not just, you know, Daniel and me, but but my wife Teresa, my mother and mom Lucille. I mean, she's the star of the show. She just takes it to another level. She's 92 and very, very sharp. Has a bit of a cheekiness to her, mm-hmm. you know, the way she sells things. And our daughter Rachel, you know, is in it. And none of the other videos, documentaries have captured the power behind the powers.
Uh-huh.
So it was really good. It was really good to be able to have that. And of course, you know, now to have that as a legacy for our grandkids, so, you know, because you're not going to be around forever, and to be able to have that captured so they can refer back to it and show their kids, you know, at some future date, you know, here's your great grandma. And of course, for our grandchildren, she's already great grandma. So, you know, this goes on to another generation. It's pretty cool.
Oh, that is very neat. And I've been telling people for a while, keep a journal, because these are extraordinary times where we're all going to look back and go, what were we thinking? You know, that's going to be part of, I hope at some point. But speaking of that story, continuity of story, you had a great article out recently I wanted to take a little dive into. It was on ecological eating. And if I could summarize, and tell me if I got this wrong, but I think you made the point that consumers have been ducking their part in the dance of healthy eating. So I'd like to talk about that here, because you made some really important points in that article.
Oh, yes, thank you. That was carried in Mother Earth News, I think it was. And Or maybe it was Acres USA. Oh, it was Acres USA, wasn't it?
Yeah, I think it was.
Acres, yep. Acres USA. And you know, I'm not trying to point any fingers, but I do kind of get a sense that farmers get beat up for whatever, for any number of things. You're producing what they produce, treating animals the way they treat them, treating the land the way they treat them, and what I wanted to do in that article was just point out that, look, the power is not in the farmers. I mean, you know, we're only half the prison population. I mean, so from a voting standpoint, you know, prisoners are, inmates are a lot more powerful, you know, constituency block in the culture than farmers are. So let's put this in perspective. The power is in the customer, the consumer. And so if you want things to change on the landscape, if you want things to change regarding, you know, chemicals, pesticides, GMOs, I mean, name your issue that you're about. If you want it to change, well, you got to make a change. And I think that too often consumers take the kind of the cop out, the convenient way out, and say, well, if those farmers would just, you know, do better or do differently, everything would be better. And the truth is that farmers have always followed the market. I mean, if people refuse to buy genetically modified organism food, farmers won't produce it. And it's really that simple. It doesn't take a government agent, a bureaucracy, a police state, a new law, nothing. I mean, all of this could be changed just by consumers taking a more active and aggressive role at financing what they say they believe in from the outset.
Well, you know, I guess the article, I mean, the what your article really goes into in that is that people do have a sense of that there's something in the system, and when the system changes, I'll be there. And you're saying, wait a minute, that's ignoring your role. You know, we do vote with our dollars, as it were. But you went through some really important things. There were five S's that you organized that around. And the first was safe, right? So Chipotle, you know, tried to buy local sourced organics or, you know, locally sourced farm foods. And then they ended up with this E. coli mysterious, in fact, a series of mysterious outbreaks in their chain. Doesn't that sort of speak to the idea that, you know, oh, we need big regulated agribusiness to keep this all safe? Or, you know, how do you respond to that?
Well, first of all, very specifically on Chipotle, you know, we service two of their restaurants, and so I've had some pretty high conversations with pretty high up people in Chipotle. We're friendly with some of them. We've been with them a long time, and they're not ruling out sabotage. This is one of the first times that an outbreak has not been able to identify a smoking gun, and that's highly unprecedented. And you got to realize, you know, Chipotle has angered a lot in the industrial food movement. They've, you know, with their cartoons their jabs at the industrial food system. They've really taken on a pretty big tiger there, a tiger that doesn't always play nice. And so it would not surprise me at all if there's some sort of a sabotage involved with that particular thing. But beyond that, you know, what's interesting is while all that with Chipotle was going on, which actually didn't hospitalize anybody, 9 people died of tainted cucumbers, but that wasn't even reported in the media, which again, you know, gives a sense of collusion within the media and big business to gang up on Chipotle and give it an unfair spotlight, if you will, and make the story bigger than it was. The truth is that the recalls and the pathogenicity, the toxicity in the food system are not coming from backyard operators. They're coming from large sanctioned agro-industrial complexes that are scrutinized and are compliant with government requirements. And so if you really want safe food, the food that that has a much less risk of the kind of things that you're concerned about, you'll actually get it from your neighborhood source rather than the big industrial complex.
You know, it's interesting. All the time we're learning more and more about how we're actually functioning as organisms here on this planet. And now they're starting to grudgingly admit things like, hey, maybe antibacterial soaps aren't so hot for reasons X, Y, Z, and on down the list. And that maybe children actually should be exposed to a wide variety of environmental factors that even they're saying now, maybe if you don't have exposure to peanuts, you're really going to maybe have a bad peanut allergy later or something like that. So we're starting to understand that yes, being exposed to the normal things that are out there in the world are important. But I think the point you're making here is that quite often, because of the way industrial agriculture is run, it has this amazing ability to really concentrate and do some astonishing outbreaks that you're right. I don't think they get a huge amount of play. Certainly not the amount of play. Like I read about there was some cantaloupes last summer and a lot of people got sick and a number of them died. And if that had been a guy with a gun on the DC Beltway, we would have heard about it, you know, endlessly.
Point well taken. And in the article, I just made the point. I kind of asked these kind of rhetorical questions. Do you feel safer in a crowd or at home? Do you trust what you know more than what you don't know? And the truth is that the more opaque and centralized and unknown food and the food system becomes, the less trustworthy it is and the more liable it is to actually engage in risky behavior because there's less accountability. So intuitively, it makes sense to understand that if you get your food from people you know rather than from strangers, it's going to have a better chance of integrity.
A better chance of integrity and a known quantity. In fact, yeah, sort of a know your farmer sort of a program would make sense there. And of course, that gets to a question I want to get to in a while. But let's keep on this track. So the second S you had was suitable. What do you mean by suitable in this case?
Well, what this means is that does the food actually fit in your ecosystem, in your nest? I mean, every region, you wouldn't expect Eskimos to eat squash in Eskimo land. Who needs salmon in Denver? Clam chowder in Kansas City. The point is that when you're in a place, think about what suits that place. Look, when I go to Hawaii, man, I live on pineapple, papaya, passion fruit, and bananas, okay? And you know, when I go, if I go to, you know, to a cherry festival, I eat cherries. And so the consumer, this is part of eating with conscious thinking. You know, Michael Pollan in some of his work has written often that most eating is done, you know, without thought. It's done thoughtlessly. And so this is just trying to bring up the idea that the food that you're eating, you know, by and large, should be available locally. It should suit the environment that you live in.
That's an interesting thought, because there's more and more we understand how our gut biome really speaks to us, talks to us, and is intimately involved in our overall construction, sense of health, even mental well-being. A variety of things are now linked to that. And so that really speaks to, you know, having an established relationship with the microflora in us, which really come mostly from the environment around us. What I'm alluding to here is that as organisms, we seem to have evolved into a place where we were supposed to be in rhythm with the things that are around us and in some sort of relationship with. So what you're saying is eating in season, not only does it make sense from, ecological terms, energy terms, but it might make sense in other terms that we don't fully appreciate yet. Is that possible?
You know, yeah, absolutely. You know, Ann Wigamore, the founder of the macrobiotic diet, which, you know, is not as famous now as it was a few years back. A few years back, it was, you know, it was the darling. It was as big as paleo for a while. It preceded paleo, so as big as paleo is now.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the principles that she espoused was resonance, was actual molecular resonance that, you know, with the magnetic bands that run to from the north and south poles on the planet, anywhere from 6 inches to 6 feet below the planet's surface, that these actually set up regional resonance. And that when you eat more than, and these change significantly about every 40 to 50 miles. So if you're eating, whatever you're eating from beyond 40 or 50 miles, it actually has a, you mentioned rhythm, but this is more molecular resonance. It has a different, frequency, if you will, energy frequency than stuff that was grown, you know, 100 miles away. Due to this kind of magnetic band and this frequency that's in each area. And so this was part of the macrobiotic idea, and it speaks directly to this whole, you know, seasonal and the suitability of a food to a place, encompasses all of those nuances of that. You know, Wendell Berry talks about being native to this place, or Wes Jackson, native to this place. And the same thing is true, you know, when we talk about food to this place, jobs to this place, work to this place. You know, it's about being moored within the parameters, boundaries, and frequencies of a place.
And, you know, the older I get, the less things surprise me. Science and our understanding of things continuously proves to me that we still don't really know a lot. We're learning more all the time, but I used to be surprised by these things. I'm less surprised these days. More open-minded, I guess. I don't know. Am I going backwards? Shouldn't I become more calcified over time? I should be more certain, but I'm less. I don't know.
you're supposed to be more callous with cynicism and contempt.
Well, I got those, but I'm still have this other curious part. Anyway, I guess that all of that leads us right to seasonal, which is your third S in this story. And I guess that, well, does that speak for itself, or is there more to that one?
Well, I think it does. It does. Obviously, it's pretty easy to understand. But I think the main thing is to understand that there are seasons. You know, our current industrial food system. You know, the same supermarket in San Diego has the same stuff in it as the one in Portland, Maine, right? And 24/7, 365. And so when you're asking for consumers to eat with the ecology, when you talk about the whole thing is about ecological eating. One of the foundations of ecological eating is to just appreciate the cyclical and the seasonality of a given area. So if we're going to eat ecologically, we're not going to eat fresh strawberries in Portland, Maine in February that are shipped air freight from Peru. You know, we're going to, if you want strawberries in Maine and Portland, you eat it in strawberry jam, you know, that you made from the previous, or, you know, frozen strawberries or dehydrated or something like that. But celebrating seasonality is something that's festive. It's not enslavement. Don't think of it as something negative. Think of it as something anticipatory, that we have something to look forward to. Oh, the first strawberry, the first green bean, whatever. These are exciting times to celebrate, and it adds a zest to cycles of life, as opposed to just same old, same old.
I love that. That makes a lot of sense, and it's not about scarcity and, oh my gosh, I've deprived myself of a fresh strawberry in Portland in February, but it's about this idea of saying that there's a magic to being in relationship to the seasons, to nature, to the rhythm of it all. Yes, that first peach in August is an amazing thing.
Right.
It really is. Oh, I like that. Thanks for building that out. Fourth S, symbiotic. What did you mean by symbiotic?
Well, symbiotic is about the relationships. The way nature works, and so we need to understand that the food that we eat should actually be working positively on the ecology, not negatively on the ecology. And so typically, feed and waste streams and things like that should be enhancing our nest rather than, harming the nest. And of course, a concentrated animal feeding operation, for example, overruns the ecology. There's no symbiosis there. It's a complete cross purposes, to the ecology. So when we're eating, we're trying to think of, okay, what is actually acting as an ecological benefit, an ecological asset, and how is what I'm eating today, is it acting symbiotically with ecological, with the ecology in the, in the region? That's pretty cool.
Yeah. This is a part that I really love about what you're up to, what the whole regenerative movement is about, what permaculture is about, is this idea that that people can do the right things and prove that we can both farm and be regenerative at the same time, that we can be in symbiosis with the larger landscape. And of course, we see how industrial agriculture is the opposite of that, with collapsing bee and pollinator, butterflies, poison streams, disappearing soils, all of that. Now, one of the critiques that keeps popping up in the media is like, oh yeah, that's all nice and everything, but we really can't feed the nation, let alone the world, with such farming practices. How do you respond to those charges, if I can even call them that?
Yeah, well, that's probably the single biggest, most common question that I get, and it has numerous answers. I do a 1 hour presentation just on that question. I won't do that right now, but I'll get a couple high points. First of all, we are overproducing what the world needs right now at the rate of 50%. No time in human civilization have we thrown away 50% of edible human food. We are doing that right now. So the point is that we could increase the world population right now by 50%, still have enough food, or we could say right now we're overproducing by 50%. Nobody in the world goes hungry because there's not enough food. They go hungry because they can't get to the food, they can't access it, they're too far away, a bomb blew out a road, somebody held up the Red Cross truck with an AK-47. You name your thing, but it's socio-political stuff, logistical stuff, transportational stuff. It has nothing to do with the fact that there's not enough food. There is absolutely plenty of food on the planet. That's number one. Number two is that there is a tremendous amount of unutilized or underutilized land. I mean, just take the U.S. We have 35 million acres of lawn and 36 million acres growing and housing and feeding recreational horses. That's 71 million acres. That's enough to feed the entire country without a single farm or ranch. So right. You know, when you start, and I haven't even gotten to golf courses yet. Okay. So I'm not opposed to horses. I'm not opposed to lawns. I'm not opposed to, you know, to golf courses. But what I am suggesting is that this henny penny running around, the sky is falling, we can't feed the world, and we're already overpopulated, is simply not true. There is a tremendous amount of available land that could be utilized. Number three, the land that we are using for farming, we're using it in an extremely inefficient way. Monocrops, monocultures are extremely inefficient. What's efficient, what nature does, of course, are very intricate, complex, relational polycultures. And even the most rudimentary backyard garden, the beginner's backyard garden is more productive per square yard than the most, you know, elite monocropped industrial operation that just produces one crop. Why? Because even in a rudimentary backyard garden, we're mixing plants, mixing vegetables, and there's a symbiosis and a synergy and an increase in productive capacity that happens there. So we can grow a lot more than we are. And if I could just add one more tidbit, that is that especially our cattle, our beef and dairy are being extremely inefficient because we're not managing our pastures in a choreograph that mimics the way bison and wolves float across the Native American prairie. It should give us all pause to realize that 500 years ago there were more pounds of animals being produced in the U.S., what would become the U.S., than there are today, even with chemical fertilizers, John Deere tractors, and hybrid seeds. You know, Audubon sat under a tree, said he couldn't see the sun for 3 days for the flock of passenger pigeons mm-hmm. that flew over. I don't know about you, but I haven't seen the sun blocked out with a flock of birds for 3 days, ever. You know, herds of bison that were in the millions. There were you know, way over 100 million head of bison, over 1 million wolves, 2 million beavers. The antelope, the elk, the prairie chickens, the pheasants, the turkeys, the waterfowl, the prodigious amount of life on the landscape and waterscape was just far beyond anything we can imagine today. And what we've done is we've taken all this amazing life, and we've relegated it to some fringes in little tiny places, from concentrated animal feeding operations to, you know, to the fringes of our azaleas in the city off our nuked suburban lawn that's a monoculture of nothingness. And the truth is that we could be far, far more productive on our farm by moving the cows every day to a fresh paddock using high-tech electric fencing to model after the model of the animal movement in nature. We're getting five times the county average production per acre, and that's without planting a seed or buying a bag of chemical fertilizer in 50 years. You know, these principles work. And, you know, imagine if the neighbors all got five times the county average, and then their neighbors got five times, and the whole county and the whole state. I mean, my goodness, the truth is that we haven't even scratched the surface on production. So not only can our system feed the world, ultimately it's the only system that actually can.
And over the long term, I assume it's really the only one that makes sense to me, and I think anybody who rationally looks at this. You can't look at mining your soils and losing your soils and treating your soils until it becomes dirt and blows away without saying, wow, that's probably not a sustainable way to go about this. But as far as I can tell, Joel, the whole mainstream media, Wall Street, the financial crowd, they're all there trying to tell me every day, I'll speak for myself, that everything's okay. I just got to ignore any warning bells I'm seeing. I have to keep on buying and borrowing. I got to consume a little more. I go down that path. But what you're really saying here is that first, industrial farming just doesn't have a future at some point, but that we already know how to begin going about doing things in a correct way or a more relational way or even a more sustainable way in a true sense of that word, but we're not doing it. Why is that generally?
Well, that's the million-dollar question, and I tell people, you know, when they look at when they come like to visit the farm, and they say, "Wow, this intuitively." I mean, I'm not a farmer, but of course, this is the way it ought to be done. Well, you know, why doesn't everybody do it? And I just, you know, my answer is that if this model became the new orthodoxy, it would completely invert the power, position, prestige, and profits of the entire world's food and farming system. And that's a big, not only is that a big ship to turn around, but that's a lot of egos, a lot of, life investment to have impugned, if that were abandoned. And so, you know, every orthodoxy, every status quo system, takes a defensive posture, circles the wagons when it's under assault. And, I mean, whether it's taxi drivers that are being taken out by Uber or whatever, there's a defensive position that says, we've got to protect this at all costs. And, you know, Gandhi used to say that, what happens when innovation of thought comes to a political arena, first they ignore you and then they, laugh at you and then they fight you and then you win. And that was his kind of four-step progression of the way, you know, societal, you know, evolution moves. And I think that's right. I think first of all, you know, that the system does all it can to ignore us. And then they began laughing at us, and now they're fighting us. And, you know, they're saying things like, outdoor animals are more pathogenic. They're saying things like, you know, compost piles are unsafe. You know, there's sex going on in them air piles. You know, and we can't let that. We got to have, you know, sterile 10-10-10 to put out there. Not have a bunch of bacteria and microbes. And there's this universal sterilization idea. We need to sanitize and sterilize everything. When, you know, actually you and I have 3 trillion. Bacteria inside of us. We're far, far from sterile. And we have these ideas proliferating in our culture, and they engender fear. They engender fear among people. And of course, when people are fearful, then they're ready to accept government-approved security. And as Ben Franklin said, you know, when you're willing to give up your freedom for security, you get and deserve neither.
Well, we're certainly far down that path, and I have a question that I think pokes at that one towards the end. I want to finish out this your fifth S, which was seamless in this article, and I think you got to that with this idea of wanting to see the same things in San Jose as I do in Bangor in the grocery stores. But what did you mean by seamless in this case?
Yeah, well, seamless. A lot of people don't realize all of the things that have the chains that have to be in place in order to supply, non-seasonality and industrial food. And, from longshoremen that aren't on strike to, you know, the cheap flow of energy to transport to, you know, whatever, favored nation status, diplomatic relations, and then, you know, logistics, getting it into a warehouse, and having it keep shelf life, all those sorts of things. You know, there are a lot of pieces of that. Whereas when you buy something from a local producer, you look the farmer in the eye, that's a very seamless chain of custody there. You know, it directly from field to fork, if you will. And that seamlessness has far more accountability. There's less risk there of something going awry and tearing apart the system when it's a much tighter seam. So it's all about localization and having, you know, a local centric idea. And so ultimately, you know, eating ecologically is not going down and getting organic certified from New Zealand.
Mm-hmm.
It's actually coming clear outside the established food system and investing in finding your good sources and making food decisions based on knowledge, information, and the skill that comes with participation. So many times, you know, we want something different. People complain about the way things are and want something different, but they want somebody else to make, you know, if those people over there, if they just do this, you know, then everything would be okay. Well, what you find out is, as you start down that road, there isn't them and us. It's all us.
Mm-hmm.
And so if we want, you know, if we want to have a different situation, well, you know, we have to make that situation for ourselves by deciding to make changes in our own lives.
Absolutely. Change begins with each of us first. And that's really the summation of that article you wrote, which is, look, people, if you want different results, you're going to have different actions on your own end. If the consumer is not there demanding, and the consumer is not just the individual, it could be universities, it could be restaurant chains, it could be
sure,
supermarkets, right? But if the consumer
Absolutely.
Isn't demanding, I think demand precedes supply. Right. You get the demand and the supply will show up. We'll turn those golf courses and horse ranches into, you know, organic pepper farms if we have to. Right. If the demand is there.
Absolutely. No question. No question at all. So to assume that we're doomed or, you know, we can't meet our needs is simply, coming at it from both ignorance and paranoia. And when ignorance combines with paranoia, you've got a double whammy.
I thought of some names, but that's okay. Double whammy's good. So, what you're talking about here is social change, it's culture change. And you've dragged out that wonderful Gandhi quote, which says, look, there's a process to this. I'm interested in that process, and I'd like your firsthand experience with this, because you must have seen a lot of people come through Polyface Farm to take the tour to observe. What sort of shifts and trends have you noticed in the types and maybe composition of people who are showing up to see what you're up to?
Oh, well, you know, it's very, very interesting. 30 years ago, pretty much all of our visitors were what I call, kind of liberal earth muffins, you know, kind of leftover hippies.
Yep.
And then we started to see about 15, 20 years ago some pretty major shifts and many, many more kind of conservatives. And I think that many of them were homeschoolers. We're now seeing a huge interest and, you know, visitors from the homeschooling community. And I think what happened there was that people decided to get out of the institutional public education system and embrace this homeschooling thing and found it very satisfying. And then they woke up one morning and said, wow, you know, that was fun to express some, you know, a rebellious streak in that. I wonder if it would be just as satisfying to opt out of conventional thinking in medicine or food or investment or recreation or you know, whatever. And next thing you know, this thing that started educationally now morphs into a milk cow out back in a hand-operated grain mill in the kitchen. that's the natural morphing.
Yep.
And as the opt-out, what I call the opt-out mentality, the opt-out of orthodoxy, as that gains status, excitement, and actually brings solutions to life, to things, to struggles, when you actually have solutions to struggles, man, it's the snowball. You know, it's the snowball that you say, well, you know, that one worked. What's the next one? What's the next one? What's the next one? And that's what we see among people, is that they're on a journey. Everybody has an aha moment. You know, maybe it was a disease, maybe it was something they read, something they saw, something they heard. But there's this kind of conversion aha moment where the light went on, and they had, for the first time, they said, I wonder if the government lies to me. it's like that's the first light that goes on, you know. Maybe every government scientist, report, expert, whatever, is not the gospel. And as soon as they're willing to posit a bit of incredulity to the official speak, you mentioned, you know, Wall Street says, oh, everything's great, you know, it's all super. You know, as soon as that official speak becomes suspect in your mind, wow, all sorts of assumptions begin to fall, because you begin to research, and you're, you know, it's like your eyes are open, you know, and you suddenly realize, you know, a lot of this orthodox assumption is a house of cards.
I absolutely agree. That was my own process. There were a number of things that caused me to really begin to question. And as soon as you go down that rabbit hole, there's no end to it. And of course, you know, we're all raised to believe, have faith in authority, and, you know, get out the big foam finger, we're number one, all of that. And you scratch at things and you go, hey, wait a minute, there's lots of ways to do things, and there's good and bad, and there's, you know, right ways and wrong ways and all of this. But it's not as black and white, I guess, as when I was raised. That little grayer as I get into this zone now. And so this is really, you know, what I'm tapping into here is this idea that this social change, it really feels like that's in the air. Maybe it's just because we have the super contentious political presidential cycle underway, but it seems like people are staying in increasing numbers. I don't exactly know what's wrong, but the narrative seems off. I want it to be different. And I think that's a first step in this process. And it's just fun. It's fun for me to watch the mainstream media do everything it can to either ignore it or reshape it or reframe it. But the truth is, more and more people are waking up to the idea that the way we're doing things is not how they would like them to be done, and starting that becomes political change at its heart. So you're really doing something political at heart, aren't you?
Well, yes. Again, I go back to the power, position, prestige, and profitability of the entire food and farming system would be turned on its head if what we believed and what we did became practiced by even 20%. And because we don't, you know, we don't buy the same things, we don't believe the same things, we don't, you know, we don't patronize the same businesses. I mean, it's a complete upside down view of things. We like to ask, you know, how small can it be? They like to ask, how big can it be? We like to ask, you know, how can we do this with animals that appreciate? They want to ask, how can we do this with machinery that depreciates? We want to try to figure out, you know, how do we get more people on the farm? They want to say, how few people can we have on the farm? You know, they want to see how cheap food can be. We want to ask how good food can be. I mean, the most basic foundational questions are just opposite. They're just completely opposite. And I agree with you. I think that societal pendulums, well, they never hang in a balance, that they're always off to one side or the other. And what happens is the pendulum has to swing far enough to one side before it finally stops and then starts coming back. And that distance of how far it has to swing before it comes back is actually frustratingly far.
Right.
You know, the profits, as soon as it comes off balance, they start, you know, warning, hey, we gotta change, and it just keeps on going and going and going. And finally, hopefully before civilizations collapse, but often not before civilizations collapse or go through a complete, whether it's the Bolshevik Revolution or whether it's Hitler or, whatever it is, that there's some, major change. And then that pendulum, and then what happens is, typically, the pendulum swings past back balance and goes completely over to overcorrection on the other side, and you have something else. That's typically what happens. But yeah, I agree. I think that as more and more people become frustrated and disenfranchised with their personal health, their personal life, their family's dysfunction, the lack of a community civility in local solutions to local problems, the overreaching regulatory environment, the centralization of power in our country so that localities can't innovate things because they've always got to be looking over the shoulder and see what the feds, what the feds have to say about it, and the grant proposals and the cost sharing monies and what strings are attached to this, and find their hands tied to be able to innovate policy changes within their community. All of those kind of things add up to incendiary rage and frustration. And I think both the Bernie Sanders and the Trump phenomena are opposite sides of the same coin. The same coin is exactly just what you said, where people realize that something is really wrong. The ones that are predisposed to want centralized solutions look to Bernie, and the people that just want to be angry or go for Trump, and they're both disenfranchised, disempowered, and grasping for solutions.
Well, in that pendulum model you've got, there's a kind of probably an uncomfortable sense of weightlessness at that shift point, right? As the pendulum reaches the apex of its swing, like, ooh, I'm floating here. So I really think there is that I have that sense that the social mood is and there's a very important shift there also just in the public mood around a lot of things. And so it's wonderful to be talking to somebody sort of at the forefront of that, gets to see the liberal earth muffins turn into the conservative people. By the way, my own financial advisors have come and toured your farm. So just to put that all in context. So,
cool.
Yeah. Hey, you've got a new book coming out, I understand, in just a month or two. Would you be willing to tell us about it?
I would be delighted to. Yes. This is my 10th book. I call it my coming out book. Those who know me well know that, I've taken this voluntary moniker, Christian, libertarian, environmentalist, capitalist, lunatic, farmer. And I did start that several years ago in order to dispel, the stereotypes that, this organic or, organic farmer walks in a room and everybody assumes that, I love unions and I love, abortion and I'm for bigger taxes, bigger government and, blah, blah, blah. And so just to try to dispel that pigeonhole, that stereotype that, we're all prone to, we want to get people in our boxes, right? And we don't like people that don't fit a box. So I basically came up with a Christian libertarian environmentalist capitalist lunatic farmer to just say, look, one minute you'll think I'm a communist, the next minute you'll think I'm a libertarian, the next minute you'll think I'm, a raving environmentalist, and the next moment you'll think I'm a complete, Adam Smith capitalist, whatever. And so it was a nice humorous way to do that. So this book, number 10, is my coming out book, and the title is The Marvelous Pigness of Pigs, Nurturing and Caring for All God's Creation. And it is overtly Christian. It is keyed to the 34% of Americans who consider themselves part of the faith community. But it's also written for people not of faith to appreciate that don't blame the faith community for what, unfortunately, the faith community tends to say. Realize that the Judeo-Christian biblical basis has been you know, what, misapplied, misunderstood by, you know, the faith community. And so the thesis of the book is that all of physical creation is an object lesson of spiritual truth. So the things that we embrace in the faith community, from, you know, faith, forgiveness, long-range view, whosoever will, neighborliness, all these great truths that we embrace from the pew, what do they look like on the menu? And so I have a, you know, a bookshelf full of books written about, you know, stewardship from a theological academic standpoint, but nothing really tells me what does this look like on the plate? What does this look like on a farm? What does this look like in a food system? And so it's a very visceral, dirt under the fingernails approach to identifying how these spiritual principles appear in the physical world around us. Does forgiveness farming look more like a Tyson or more like a Polyface, for example? And my little half a second soundbite for the book is, this is Rachel Carson for Christians. And I think because I am one, I have a lot of experience. I know the language. I know the lingo. I know the strengths and the weaknesses. And so I can speak, you know, to my people, if you will, from a place of credibility and veritas, rather than, you know, just be out here as a non-member finger pointing and saying, you know, if you guys would just do this and that and the other. Now, you know, you could write a similar book for any sector of the society, but I really feel like there's a hunger and a yearning in the faith community among churches, like you said, they're starting to think, wow, I wonder if I wonder if God cares whether my refrigerator is full of, you know, Coca-Cola and Velveeta cheese. Is that something that matters? And does it have an effect on the landscape? And, I mean, if God owns all this, well, does he have a say in this? And how do I then make sure that God gets a return on his investment of creation and, you know, if he owns it all? And so, you know, these are questions that are just beginning to surface, and it's been, I've enjoyed doing several, pastoral retreats and stuff, and I'm just hearing people wrestle with these issues like I've never heard before. I think partly because their congregants are sick, they're old, they're desperate for how do we create messaging that is so exciting and future valid that it attracts young people back to our congregation, back to the faith, and gives us something to get our teeth into, to embrace. It's not just, you know, theoretical focus group stuff. And so, you know, this is the book, and I'm very excited. It's going to be released May 7th under the Faith Words imprint. It is the cover is already on Amazon.com. I don't know if they're taking pre-orders or not, but it's very, very close.
The Marvelous Pigness of Pigs, and can't wait for that to come out. I'm going to read it, because you're speaking to a topic which is near and dear to my heart. I take a slightly different orientation on it, but the common ground here is that this life we've created for ourselves is in many ways unfulfilling. It's deeply unfulfilling, and I don't know a lot of people who found their spiritual faith in Facebook, or however you want to look at that. Yeah, there's just a questioning of there's got to be more to this, right? Because let's face it, a consumer lifestyle is really not a fulfilling lifestyle. It's got a little dopamine burst when you first get the big brown truck of happiness dropping off your new purchase. It goes away in a couple hours, right? And then you got to do it again. It's not lasting. It's not fulfilling. So there is this deeper question that people are looking for. So thank you for daring to come out and and go there for the people you can speak to. Speaking to people, last thing, you've got an upcoming event in Sonoma County, California. I understand at some place Terra Firma Farms, April 23rd. I guess that's going to be in Petaluma. What can you tell us about that?
Well, this is at Terra Firma Farm there in Petaluma, and they're just doing a great job there with pastured livestock, direct marketing, working with other local farmers, as part of a significant element in this local environmental food system. In a climate, I may add, that has its problems. I mean, every climate has its problems, but that Mediterranean climate with the wet season and the dry season does present problems, as well as terrain. That part of California has a lot of steep terrain, and so it does create some issues. But there's a lot of assets as well, and they're definitely trying to capitalize on that. So we'll be doing a farm walk and a presentation there, and I'll be doing a public presentation there at the farm. And always delightful to spend time with the folks there at Terra Firma Farm.
Absolutely. I understand Paul Kaiser of Singing Frog Farms will be there. Toby Hemingway, the permaculture writer. Rob Wolf, I understand. I've heard from him. He's planning on coming too. So he of the paleo movement.
Oh, boy.
Yeah. So
not like you have more information than I do.
Well, I know Rob. He's pretty. He's so excited that he would get to meet you there. And so anyway, we'll include a link to that in the write-up that accompanies this podcast, so folks can learn more about how to attend that event.
Good.
And
great.
And also your book as well, because we just want more people to know about what you're doing and why you're doing it and how you're doing it. And so we'll make that as easy as possible. So thank you so much for your time today, Joel. As always, a huge pleasure, very informative and thought-provoking.
Thank you, Chris. My pleasure.